Yesterday I mentioned that I had wrongly attributed a rumor spread about Ellen White. If you have it on your tape, I would like you to erase it. I also mentioned a meat hook. This is a meat hook. Came out of the old home of Ellen White. Every fall, her father used to hang a hog by its back legs from this meat hook. I was very glad I purloined it from her house a week or so before it was burned down, and now it's a soggy mess and a hole in the ground. It's very interesting to me when I read her story of her life, that meat hook makes a memory. This evening I want to consider the writing of the testimonies and the other works of Ellen White. I have here a facsimile of a letter that she wrote to Elder Washburn. He had it duplicated. It shows you Ellen White's writings, and it shows you zero error. So when the meeting concludes, you may want to take a look at it. This is in her handwriting. About a year ago, somebody gave me these two venerable books. Come take a look at these when they're through. While you're looking at them, remember they belong to me, and I'm not giving them away. They have printed in front of them Dr. D.H. Kress. They contain the personal testimonies that Ellen White wrote to the two Drs. Kress. And there are six letters in here written in Ellen White's own handwriting. These are the originals. And copies of these are in the White Estate, which you will see from the top left-hand corner. Copied by White Estate. Dear brother and sister, I have matter, etc., for you. As you look at this, you will see the kind of handwriting she had. You will also see that she could write a letter of two pages without making one correction. And if you care to look through very carefully, these the other five are also here. They contain several letters that are rubber stamped. Now this rubber stamp testimony is one that brought about quite some discussion in the days gone by. If I can find this. Willie White was asked, see, every criticism that has ever been leveled against Ellen White has been leveled periodically every decade. Every generation has to make its own mind up. And every generation goes through the same process of criticism. I haven't encountered a new criticism of Ellen White anywhere. This book is Nichols, Ellen White, and Her Critics. And many, many years ago, the criticism was leveled. Why these rubber stamp testimonies? That was the term that was used about them. And Willie White, who was then corresponding from the White Estate, wrote that when his mother wrote a manuscript or a testimony or a letter that she wanted copied. Now she sent many as you will see six here in her own handwriting, directly. But they made maybe six copies of that letter, and Ellen White would sign number one. And that number one was kept in the office. It was not sent. And the other four or five, or however many copies were made, were stamped with the signature Ellen G. White, which you will also see. Can't see it from where you're looking, but you can come up and look at it. In which she stamped with a rubber stamp Ellen G. White, which authorized that to be sent. So that if any time a question arose about the validity, the changed content, or any question arose about a manuscript or a letter or a testimony, the original is in the White estate. Except for those, as I've said here, of which the originals may be still possessed by some Seventh-day Adventist somewhere. I was given a three-page letter that had been typed out, that was signed by Ellen White, not a rubber stamp, it was signed by her. And I had it for some years at BUC, but then one day I came and looked, and my file only contained the first two. The page with the signature is now in somebody's collection. May the Lord be merciful to his soul and bring about repentance and retribution and return or anything else if he ever hears a tape recording of this talk this evening. I'd like it back wherever it is. Now, as she wrote this material, sometimes 5, sometimes 6, sometimes 15, sometimes 18 pages a day, she would hand it to her helpers. That's what she called them, my helpers. And she had many helpers at different times. She writes a letter here that Nicol quotes in the appendix of his book, in which the various helpers are noted. On page 658, the Lord has given me other faithful helpers in my work. Many of my discourses have been reported. See, when she preached, she had those who took her discourses down in shorthand. In fact, there are scores of discourses that have never been typed out since they were taken down in shorthand. If any of you know how to read the personal shorthand of Elder Doris Robinson and can go back and read the shorthand that they wrote 80 years ago, you may be able to transcribe those. You'd need to be some sort of a cryptographer. Many of my discourses have been reported and have been put before the people, printed form. Through nearly the whole of my long experience, I have endeavored day by day to write out that which was revealed to me in vision of the night. Many messages of counsel and reproof and encouragement have been sent out to individuals, and much of the instruction that I have received for the church has been published in periodicals, books, circulated in many lands. As the work has grown, the number of my helpers has increased. Sister Marion Davis, copying the testimonies, preparing for publication the manuscripts I placed in her hand. I appreciate her help very much. Now she sleeps in Jesus. For 11 years, Miss Maggie Hare. Then recently, Miss Minnie Hawkins. I've got some mysteries because some of these testimonies that were written to Cress have got by the side of her signature, you know, as a secretary writes, M.H., and I don't know whether they're Maggie Hare or Minnie Hawkins. I'll have to go and find out. Now, this one that I'm looking at particularly has R by the side of it, and I presume that's Doris Robinson. He has assisted in copying my testimonies and has been diligently preparing life incidents for publication. He also prepared the story of our health message from which I quoted last night. During the General Conference of 1901, Brother C.C. Chrysler was impressed by the Spirit of God that I needed him in my work. He offered his services. I gladly accepted his help. He is a faithful, efficient, conscientious worker. Helen Graham is a good stenographer, helped Sister Sarah McKentifer and W.C. White. Sarah Peck was my bookkeeper and helper for a number of years. She has left to engage in schoolwork at College View. We now have as a bookkeeper Brother Paul C. Mason. Sister McKentifer is my traveling companion, nurse, helper in many ways. Sister Mary Stewart and her mother are with me now. Mary, who for many years served as proofreader in the office of Battle Creek in Nashville, has united with my helpers. As the work is constantly moving forward, we are making earnest efforts to place my writing before the people. If I am incapacitated for labor, my faithful workers are prepared to carry forward the work. So she would write, and her helpers, as she called them, would read her writing, and when typewriters were invented, start to type them out. For the first decades of her writing ministry, they would write carefully by hand. But as soon as the typewriter was invented and became reasonably obtainable, then, of course, typewriters were used. And they used various kinds of carbon paper. As you can see, some of them are greenish, and some of them are bluish, and some of them are blackish. And 80 years after, their impression is not quite as it was perhaps when they were in their pristine state. Now, the thought is often entertained and frequently expressed that since Ellen White didn't complete the third grade, that therefore her writing was of the quality of a third grade dropout. Now, there are various ways of considering that. To try to explain it, there are those who maintain that these helpers, who had much longer time in school and therefore were better grammarians, would be able to correct and fill in and punctuate and improve what Ellen White, in her ignorance and lack of education, would write. But now it should be borne in mind that besides writing, Ellen White was a very, very popular public speaker. When you read her diary or read her biography or autobiographical sections in different parts, you are amazed at the number of meetings that lady took. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 a week. And those talks were not 5-minute talks either. Some of them were 90 minutes long. And I don't know how fast she spoke, but my speaking rate is about 160 words a minute. So if she spoke at 150 words a minute, you can figure out how many words she produced in 90 minutes. And then you can look in and see what her speeches sounded like when the stenographers took them down. F.D. Nickel has got several quotations here from various newspapers reporting her talks. With one voice, they are deeply impressed with her oratorical ability, her fluency. If you can get hold of the historical sketches of Seventh-day Adventist missions, any of you ever heard of that little volume? Historical sketches of Seventh-day Adventist missions. I have one, so I don't break the Tenth Commandment anymore, but I did for a long time. It is a book containing notes of travel that Ellen White wrote when she went to Europe. She starts out here in the West and crosses the United States and takes ship and goes to England and to Switzerland, up into Scandinavian countries. Her descriptions of what she sees out of the train and what she experiences on the boat and her talks that she gave there, some of those are available, I think, in Selected Messages or the latest Gospel Workers, Morning Talks, they're called. They were taken down stenographically and have been printed. She was invited to speak on temperance in Christiania. That's now called Oslo. And other Norwegian and Swedish and Danish cities. She was invited by the mayors of some of those cities to functions at which she spoke through a translator. And the Scandinavian newspapers reported the speeches made by this American woman. And invariably those reports in a foreign country are again impressed with her ability as a speaker. The whole big, big numbers, 3,000, 5,000 people. What sort of a voice production ability that lady had never ceases to impress me. At the other end of my ministry, there were no mics. And in the 30s, we spoke in theaters and really tried to push. Did everything that voice production is supposed to do to get the sound across. But in these days of electronic devices, for which I am deeply grateful, some kindly soul wires us up with electricity, and then we can go from there without any effort. Now Ellen White, as she spoke and as she advised others of the ministers, emphasized that the speaking should be in a conversational tone. And how possibly I could maintain a conversational tone if I had 5,000 people in a big auditorium to try to hear. And there were some of them looking at me like this all the time. I have never figured out. But those who listened to her, those who remember her, and I've talked to two or three of them, were greatly impressed with the carrying power of her voice. And Elder Marion Cady, how many of you know Elder Cady or knew of him? He has gathered together out of Ellen White's books her testimonies on voice production and voice culture. He must have a compilation of 300 pages that Ellen White wrote at different times over 70 years. And I wrote to him and asked him for a copy. He said I'd buy one in the early 50s. And he wrote back that now he was left to his one last ewe lamb, that he was sorry he couldn't part with it. So I dried my tears and grinned and gritted my teeth and bore my loss. Then about 15 years later, I got a very charming note. Maybe it wasn't that length of time, from Sister Cady. She says, my husband has passed away and I've been looking through his letters and you seem to want this book. If you still want it, you're very welcome to it. So now I have it in my bookcase. Now this lady could give very, very technical information on voice production, voice placement, voice projection, breathing, relaxation, differential relaxation. She didn't use these terms. But any technician in the craft of speaking, whose livelihood was by public address, can recognize her insights while she didn't have the vocabulary. So what I'm saying is that beside her writing, there is an enormous amount of records of her speaking. When I taught homiletics in college, I gathered together about the bibliography of about 120 of her sermons. And one of my assignments for a little section of that course was to give the students the job to analyze those 120 sermons. There are many more that are available, but that's the number I had. To try to get the setting, what was the occasion for this talk, what kind of audience did she have, and how did she address her audience and construct the discourse that she had prepared for them. And then to analyze the discourse, the number of texts, the kinds of paragraphing, the way the thought was developed, the main point that she had to make, the sort of application and appeal that she made at the end. What were her introductions? How did she begin? She began many, many different ways. And so as you analyze that production, that literary production, over which she had no control, in the sense that she could rely upon the help of literary assistants. She was there speaking on her own. The quality of what she said was no different from the quality of what she wrote. And so the secretaries would take and would, if you took an oral address, say somebody is taking down a tape recording of what I'm saying here. Then you sit down on a typewriter and you decide to reduce that to typescript. I don't know whether you've ever done that. But let me tell you, it wouldn't sound readable. It wouldn't. There would be spaces, there would be unfinished sentences, hanging sentences. Why? Because oral address and written literary products are two different things. As soon as I think I've got my idea across to you, I quit in the middle of a sentence. You do the same. You listen to your conversation. You look at the person and you say, well, I've got it over, let's quit, let's go to something else. But when you write it out, you've got to finish the whole sentence. Well, when some of those oral discourses were to be prepared as articles, then they would require a treatment. Somebody would have to sit down and punctuate them. I pause at various times. Sometimes I even don't pause. It just goes on. But if you wrote it, there would have to be commas and colons and semicolons and periods somewhere along the line. And if I'm quoting something, I don't say quote, so-and-so, end quotes. I just read. Now, if you were reducing this to a typescript, then you'd have to put marks of quotation. Now, I'm saying here, this is all found in F.D. Nichols, Ellen White, and her critics. But if it was prepared for an article, somebody would have to get down and say, now, this quotation, and he put it in quotes, is from page 469. So the literary assistants, the helpers that she had, they had all kinds of work to do. But they didn't change what she was saying. Sometimes when she first started out, she used the word learned for taught. If any of you have ever made a list of Ellen White's grammatical errors, please share it with me. I'm collecting those. It's a very small list so far, but that's one of them. Today we say he taught his son. In 1851, she would say he learned his son. She also said at the beginning, don't, for doesn't. I have noticed once she talked about these kind of people. I've heard college presidents with two doctor's degrees talk about these kind of people. Well, her literary assistants would have very little problem about correcting bits and pieces like that. Another mistake that she makes, she talks about lodgings or a home or hospitality being given to her husband and myself. My mother used to do that a lot too. It's my husband and me. Not husband and myself. And I venture to suggest that in this group today, there are some dozens of people who would do that, say like that. And the reason I've tried to analyze it, I've listened to people, I haven't listened to any more for the next 10 minutes when I've heard them say this, and I've tried to analyze now why are they using this, and I think it's a kind of a modesty. You don't want to say I, and you don't want to say me. And you think you're softening the personal pronoun that is connected with pride and boasting by saying myself. That's the only conclusion I can come to. Now she would do that. Now, when the spiritual gifts and then spirit of prophecy, 1, 2, 3, 4, you ought to buy both those sets. The two little chubby volumes of spiritual gifts and now the photo facsimiles of the four volumes of Spirit of Prophecy, or Great Controversy, 1, 2, 3, 4. Buy those and read the one and then read the other. And watch the expanding development as Ellen White was given further and further visions concerning this. Now in the early ones, as I have already mentioned, the need to put into marks of quotation didn't exist. The need to give footnote credits was not current practice. But as the 19th century progressed, the educational, cultural, literary atmosphere changed. And so if you look at Great Controversy, that's the fourth volume of the four-volume series, came out in 1884, and then compare it with the one that came out in 1888. I was looking to see if I could bring you one, but I've got an 1886 and an 1887, but I haven't got an 1888 that I could lay my hand on. But I think I have one somewhere. The changes in the format is what impresses us. Now that stayed until 1911. At which time she re-read, re-edited, and partly wrote. That's the great controversy we now have. Some changes because of the light and because of the change in layout. Now, quotes were given, footnotes were given, a bibliography was added, a big index was added. Now you look at books 100 years ago, printed. Very few of them have indexes. Very few of them in indexes. And indexes are a pain. The book I published, I thought I was so delighted to get it published in London, just rejoicing as the last galley sheet was sent away, and then I got a letter from the editor. Now we'd like an index of this thing. And the best person to make an index is the author. So I had to sit down and go through this thing and make an index. And an index is a pain in the neck. It's nice to have one, but to make one and then proofread all those columns and columns and columns and make certain they're on the page. So as the emphasis in literary style changed, the writings of Ellen White, while the content was unchanged, except by her express will, the whole format and layout of them have altered. Now, if you look at the first Christ object lessons and compare it with the current one, the first ministry of healing, and compare it with the current one, the first steps to Christ, that was published by Revell. Have you seen that one? Hardback, pale cream color book. That was the only book that the brethren wanted, decided to get published by an outside publisher. But they bought back the copyright pretty quick. And it's very fortunate they did, because that's gone into many, many millions of copies. So this gives you a little picture of how her helpers collaborated with her in getting her written and oral discourse and her manuscripts and whatever else she wanted to do in a form suitable for publication, while not altering in any way the content or the thought or the major expressions that she used. And if you look at her letters, when you finally boil it down, the actual changes were minimal.